Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter and producer at The World, covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a weekly series of coronavirus conversations in partnership with the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you here in The World's podcast feed. This last week, we tackled an issue on everyone's mind: safely reopening workplaces during the pandemic. Joining me was Joe Allen. He's an assistant professor of exposure assessment science, and he directs the Healthy Buildings Program at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health.
So let's get to it. Joe, employers are considering right now reopening offices and other workplaces. Workers are wrestling with these uncertainties and how to do this best, getting back to work. As this all takes the spotlight right now in Senate hearing as we speak, what are the very first things that workplaces should be thinking about to make this transition as safe as possible?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm glad to be with you and everyone who's joining us to talk through this over the next 30 minutes. It can seem chaotic and overwhelming, but hopefully with some science-based strategies, we can help people get through it. That question of how to reopen safely is not a million-dollar question. It's quite literally the trillion-dollar question. And I think there are some strategies companies can take right away as they prepare for how to repopulate or return to office when the time is right. So one of the strategies we've been talking about and using actually comes from my field of worker health and safety. It's a framework we've used for decades. It's called the hierarchy of controls. It's a layered defense, five-part strategy. I'll go through it real quickly, and then we can get into deeper if we want during question and answer. But the first in the hierarchy is elimination. Can you eliminate the hazard? We can do that from working from home for those who can. The next is substitution. So who has to go back? Who are the core people that need to be back in your building to keep your business functional? They and only they should go back. Three are engineering controls. And here, this is where we talk about healthy building strategies. And I think we'll talk a lot about that. Fourth are administrative controls, thinking about how do you de-densify the building. And last is PPE, or personal protective equipment. And this is the use of wearing masks. It's a nice framework because it gives some sense to the, or provides some order to the chaos. It's grounded and rooted in good scientific and worker health and safety practice. And we approach it knowing that there's no such thing as zero risk. The goal is to minimize risk, and this layered defense strategy can get us there.
One of the things that you focus on is this notion of healthy buildings. What do you mean by that? Like, how do you make a building healthy when you think about these layered control strategies?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, we've been in the era of sick buildings, and I can talk about the history of that. I think it's quite interesting. And maybe now for the first time in history, everyone is recognizing just how important the built environment and our indoor environments are to our health. And it's ushering in very quickly this healthy building movement, where we don't just go for disease avoidance, we go for indoor spaces that can enhance, promote, protect our health. You know, we spend 90% of our time indoors. We are an indoor species. The indoor environment has an outsized impact on our health. But I bet if I asked you, Alana, you know, what does it take to lead a healthy life? You'd come back to me and say, well, I know I have to exercise today. I know what I should eat for lunch or dinner that's healthy. I know outdoor air pollution is bad for you. But very few people think about the indoor environment as having a massive impact on your health. So healthy buildings are strategies that we can employ to improve everything around us. We use the 9 foundations of a healthy building to think about all of these aspects like lighting, acoustics, air quality, water quality that we know influence our health.
I mean, one of the things, though, I'm thinking about is, like, as you think about this hierarchy and what employers can do, and we'll get into some specifics really soon because there's a lot of really great questions that have already come in. And again, as people are watching, you can post questions and join the conversation. But I mean, right now, you know, there are local jurisdictions, governments around the globe, but in the U.S. in particular, that there are guidelines that have been created, there are guidelines that have been shelved and created or revisited. And a lot of this is based on phases of where the disease is at, you know, in terms of having 2 weeks of a decline in infections as one example. But there's all this kind of differences in decision-making around when and how places broadly are reopening. And so with a kind of incomplete set of factors, it seems like a lot of the time in communities in the US, how do businesses navigate that? How do worker and workplaces navigate that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And these are certainly confusing times, but I the right approach there is this phased approach. One, first, that takes into account the factors that are happening regionally and nationally with respect to the outbreak, healthcare capacity, disease dynamics. Then when the question comes, well, how do I do it safely within my organization? I also think you need a phased approach where you move slowly, deliberately, and carefully early on and take extra precautions early on that are even over on erring on the side of being over restrictive, and including gating criteria when only if you demonstrate for an extended period of time that you can manage risk appropriately in your space through that entire hierarchy of controls, then and only then could you move to the next phase. And we have to recognize that this is not like recovering from a disaster like a hurricane where we move forward linearly, picking up the pieces and marching on. We have to be prepared that maybe we go to phase one, maybe we get to phase two in a company or an organization, but maybe you have to take a step back depending on what's happening with the disease and the dynamics around us. So it's a phased approach, but it is not a march forward, one, two, three, four, five. We have to be prepared to take a step back. In fact, we're going to have to. If you look at what the models say, that's very likely that we'll have to step back at times.
So I just want to get to questions because I think they lead so much into what people have been submitting. Here's a question from Katie. She wants to know, we operate 6 childcare centers. So we begin to head back to work around the end of June. Parents and staff are really nervous to return to the buildings as much as they want to go back to school. And so what are some specific considerations for reopening a building that's been closed for 2 weeks? 14 weeks. Practices for summer months, keeping windows open or closed. Also like disinfection practices for on a daily basis, like, yeah, let's get into the specifics a little bit.
Real specific, and I like this. And for what it's worth, I've been advising a lot of companies across different sectors of society, hospitals, law enforcement, the prisons, and commercial organizations. And I think one of the most challenging here is to think about what we're going to do with schools and daycares. I think any notion that we're going to restart the economy at some point when the time is right will require that we get this part exactly right. Mm-hmm. So there are some things you can do. First, you should be thinking about if your building has been closed or low occupancy for a long time, there are things you have to do before you get back into that space in terms of commissioning or recommissioning your air handling systems to be sure they're functioning properly if they've been turned off or really operating at a reduced capacity. Second, you have to think of things that are unrelated to COVID-19. And here I'm thinking about water quality. Really in low occupancy buildings, these are perfect conditions for stagnating water that promote bacterial growth. And I'm thinking of bacteria like Legionella that can cause Legionnaire's disease. So you also have to recommission your system there and do the appropriate flush outs. As you start to repopulate again, when the time is right, you have to have a plan in place that has these multiple control levels, including enhanced cleaning and disinfection protocols, not just which cleaner should we use, but also what's the frequency? Which surfaces should we be cleaning? What are the appropriate personal protective equipment the cleaners need to be wearing? Do they have the proper training? And on the building side, yes, there are some real specific things you want to do. You want to bring in more fresh outdoor air. If you have operable windows, open them up. Or if you have a mechanical system, 100% outdoor air. If you're recirculating some of that air, like many buildings do, you need to increase the filter efficiency of your building. We rate these in terms of what are called MERV rated filters. You want to get to a MERV 13 or higher. If your building can't do these things, there's a physical limit to what it can do. You could also consider the use of portable air purifiers that have HEPA filters and are sized appropriately for the room. So the harder part there is the administrative control side. So how are you going to segregate parents and the children so you don't have too many visitors or people coming into the space? And then, of course, how do you protect your workforce and the children at the same time? So we're going to have many enhanced cleaning protocols, but also increased hand washing and the usual.
That's a lot to take in. I mean, do you find that places are up to code on these sorts of things to begin with? And then is it easy to move into like the kind of level of resources that's needed? Because of course, these are difficult times economically.
Yeah, so a couple of things there that are really important. In terms of code, most buildings, at least on these engineering and healthy building controls, meet code and the standard. The problem is, and this will get into a little quick history, is that 100 years ago, we used to set ventilation standards, the amount of fresh outdoor air that comes in, based on infectious disease transmission. In the 70s, we switched that to be largely around energy conservation. And what we did is we tightened up our building envelopes. We stopped letting our buildings breathe. And we created the brought in this era of sick buildings. So we lost our way a bit there in terms of designing and operating buildings for health as opposed to these other conditions. So even if you're meeting these minimum standards, you should be mindful that these are minimum standards and you should try to go above and beyond these minimum ventilation standards, for example. In terms of costs, these are costs, but they're actually relatively inexpensive. And there are recommendations I can make that require big capital improvements, big expenditures. But a lot of the recommendations I'm making right now and have been over the past 2 months are things that people can do right now in their building, their office, their home, their car, based on what they have and what the system can do. So, if you can increase that fresh outdoor air, increase the filter efficiency, that'll go a long way to addressing airborne routes of exposure, and then the increased cleaning and disinfection protocols, and then maintaining the others, physical distancing, hand washing. You know, we're trying to address all three modes of disease transmission here. So it's going to require not just doing a better job with the HVAC system, but it's all these other controls as well.
Just moving from that into some of the science of this, what we know of this infection and how it's spread. This question comes from Vic, speaking of like air filtration. How much of COVID-19 do we know is airborne? It seems to be a matter of debate. Are there studies that show increased HVAC filtration efficiency reduces absenteeism due to normal communicable diseases or perhaps reduced aerosols?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll say this, we'll be debating the relative difference between the modes of transmission for this virus for decades. And I know that, and I'm confident about that because we still don't agree on the modes of transmission for influenza. And we've been studying that for a long time. But here's why I think it's totally irrelevant, right? There's evidence right now that that exposure is happening through large droplet transmission, through fomites or inanimate surfaces that act as a source of transference for the virus, like doorknobs and door handles, and airborne. In fact, myself and many other scientists who study this for a long time have been on record going back to February that there is evidence that airborne transmission is happening. WHO and CDC have not been out front on that, but we think they should be. And here's why I said it's irrelevant and doesn't matter, right? If I told you that airborne transmission was 5% or 10% or 2%, none of us right now would ever say, well, I'm not going to address that. I'll spend all my time on these other modes and I'm going to ignore airborne. I'm quite confident that we're right, that there is a risk from airborne transmission. So it argues for putting in controls that address that. If I end up being wrong, and many other scientists study end up being wrong, all you've done is just improved your HVAC performance, which has many other benefits as well. So it's really, there's a no-lose proposition here. And in terms of the scientific evidence, yes, there is evidence for other airborne diseases that increasing ventilation and filtration is effective at minimizing risk, minimizing airborne concentrations. Higher ventilation rates are associated with lower worker absenteeism. So there's plenty of evidence that suggests not only, this isn't Joe making this stuff up. The scientific evidence shows that these modes of transmission are happening, and that's why these set of controls are effective in minimizing that. So we always get grounded in the science of how we're exposed and then apply the appropriate and matching control strategies.
I want to get to a question from a dentist, but first, the 6 feet thing, is that relevant indoors in places where, what do you make of the 6 feet distance?
Yeah, so that's grounded. I'm actually glad it has taken hold because I think it's easier to understand. It's now widespread and acceptable. Increasing distance, physical distance, definitely reduces exposure. If you imagine that you and I are talking face to face, right, and I'm infectious and I cough or sneeze, many large droplets, some you may even see me spit, and that settles out quick. There'll also be large droplets that settle out that are invisible, but they're big enough that they settle out in a relatively short distance. There will also be smaller, finer aerosols that float and can spread around the room. The physical distancing is intended to address that large droplet transmission. Now, there is evidence that these droplets can go further than 6 feet. If I have a productive cough, you know, I could project this out 25 feet. But the point is that it's a good benchmark. I think it's simplified appropriately. We want to maintain this indoors. And the way we can further improve that effectiveness of that control is through mask wearing. And I've been on record for a while now that masks should be part of our public health control strategies because it acts as a physical barrier. If I do cough, it captures those large particles. So even indoors, we want to maintain and do our best to do at a minimum 6 feet of physical distancing.
Okay. Question from Leroy. How are dentists going to open their offices when the tools of the trade are air powered, which in turn would cause dispersion of fluid-filled droplets?
Yeah, I think this is another specialized environment, just like if you think about how hospitals are handling this. And again, here are multiple layers of control, infection control, but they're even more stringent, right? So here, when you think about what's happening, let's say in an airborne infection isolation room, they're bringing in a minimum of 6 air changes per hour, minimum of, they're HEPA filtering the recirculated air. That's critically important, but also their level of PPE or personal protective equipment has increased. If you think about the hierarchy of controls, you know, at first they're listed in their order of effectiveness. So eliminate the hazard, substitution, engineering controls, administrative controls, PPE. PPE is a last line of defense, but in many cases, like for example, this dental clinic example, PPE is going to have to be used. But here you want to get away from using any old cloth mask. Here you want to use an N95 respirator, possibly a face shield, and of course, increase the other protocols around hand washing and just general good public health practice while you're working with these patients.
Let's go to another specific place I've been thinking about, one that's mobile, which is, this question comes from Edric. What measures should be taken to in place for public and mass transit? The UK this morning, I don't know if it was this morning, but an official encouraged people to like look away from other people on the same transit car. So yeah,
you know, it's a great question because I think we're all starting to focus on the places that are hard to control, but maybe we spend a lot of time in elevators, bathrooms, and people are thinking a lot about public transportation. Look, I think the same general principles apply. And again, it's one of these things where everyone has a responsibility. So the government that's running the public transportation has a responsibility to put in these engineering controls, do what they can in terms of ventilation, filtration on the car, and administrative controls in terms of queuing. Companies and society have a responsibility to try and de-densify our routine. Once we reopen society and work, everyone shouldn't be rushing back at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning trying to hit these trains like we normally do. That's not going to work. So we have to extend the workday, go to A/B days, so we can de-densify the demand both at the office building, but then in transit. Last, a lot of this is going to come down to personal responsibility. In fact, the only way through this is if we all take these precautions. That means mask wearing in public. That means being hypervigilant in places like in an elevator, where there are very little controls we can put in place, and in subway cars or on a bus. I like the idea of looking away from others. Wearing a mask will also help prevent the spread of large droplets. But these are the environments where we have to be especially respectful of each other, recognizing that any of us could be a carrier of this. We know there's asymptomatic transmission that can occur. And so you want to act as if you have it and might give it to somebody else. And if you take that mindset, yeah, I think the normal thing to do would be to turn your head away, wear your mask, cover your cough, make sure to wash your hands. And maybe most importantly, don't leave the house if you're not feeling well.
Okay, so again, this is a Facebook Live. I'm here. I'm Alana Gordon with The World, here with Joe Allen with Harvard, T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We are taking your questions, and there's a ton coming in. So this question is from Teresa. I'm very concerned about all the chemicals that are being sprayed in different businesses due to COVID-19. So what is your take on this and how it can be affecting the indoor air quality of buildings and businesses, or even homes? I mean, that's kind of an interesting reverse.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm glad you brought it up. You know, I do spend a lot of time thinking about these class of chemicals. They're called VOCs, volatile organic compounds. that off gas from cleaning products, deodorants, perfumes, and certainly there are going to be more of them in the indoor environment as we do this enhanced cleaning and disinfection. I think it becomes a risk trade-off during a pandemic. So because this virus is so contagious and because the risks are so extreme for many people, if not all of us, that this is the trade-off we're going to have, right? It would never say at this moment we should scale back on cleaning disinfection. But I will say this too, if you think about all of the controls instead of each one in isolation, and we go back to this idea of higher ventilation rates, well, higher ventilation rates will also help dilute airborne contaminants, not just biological contaminants, but also chemical contaminants and VOCs. So if you pair the enhanced cleaning disinfection with enhanced ventilation, even though you have a greater chemical load in the space, that should also disperse more quickly.
And again, I just want to re-ask this, is that costly to do?
In terms of the ventilation or the cleaning? Yeah, ventilation. Yeah, so there's a cost, right? There's an energy penalty. This is going to cost more. I put it in the same, and also up enhancing your filtration is going to cost more because your fans have to work harder to push air through a more dense filter, really. But I put this in the cost-benefit equation of human health versus these costs. You know, the only way back is if we put in these aggressive controls. And already the costs to society are just staggering in terms of the economic costs. These are relatively small costs and manageable costs for most organizations and buildings to run the fans a bit more, bring in more fresh outdoor air so we can keep people safe when they return to their buildings.
This question comes from Michael. Will shift work or desks in open plan offices require disinfecting or like workstation downtime between changeovers?
Yeah, good question, Michael. I think we should expect a lot of these changes and a lot of them won't be convenient, right? I think if we're going to get back to the office, whatever that looks like in the coming months, there'll be delays on public transportation. There'll be delays on the elevator. There'll be inconveniences around cleaning and shift work. But yeah, I think it's really good practice that as companies extend the workday or have shift or companies with shifts that you build in time for enhanced disinfection between shifts. I also think it's a really good idea for organizations to start to identify even clusters or pods or teams so that if Alana and I work together and I get sick and Alana has to self-quarantine, maybe our pod or group of people, 5-10 people, self-quarantine, but the business doesn't shut down. If you have everybody running all over a building in a business at the same time and someone gets sick and everyone has been technically in close contact for some duration and you help to self-quarantine, you could quickly shut your entire business down again for 2 weeks. So I think that's another strategy as we think about not just shift, but also teams or pods.
So this question's from Jamie. Should employers do their own contact tracing if there's a possible workplace exposure? And if so, should they also be planning and training people internally to do this or bring in outside organizations? Are there recommended trainings for companies dealing with this? And I also want to tag on another question, which is like, I know not good to do, but there's also a question that comes about antibody testing and whether employers can acquire these kits. And yeah.
Sure. Yeah, good. They're related. So I'm glad you put them together because it gets to this kind of screening of employees. So a couple important things here. One, I'm not an attorney. I'm not going to give advice there, but this is something that companies should definitely be doing in consultation with their legal departments and the HR departments. From a purely scientific standpoint, yeah, I think it's a good idea. And I know some companies are starting to do this both for suspected or reported cases so that they can alert coworkers as a service to that coworker too, to say, you know, you were with someone who detected it. Other strategies employees are deploying or companies are deploying include self-certification. So before I go in for the day, I open up my company's app and I have to self-certify that I'm okay. In addition, you know, you'll likely see temperature screening at the door. It's imperfect, but it's another control strategy. I think that all fits under and gets into legal and HR and medical questions very quickly. But from a scientific standpoint, it's advisable and it's a good idea. The same thing happens as we start to think about as better testing comes online and more rapid testing. I suspect we'll start to see this as well. This as a strategy that companies roll out, they'll incorporate in addition to these other self-certification and temperature screening, they'll start incorporating some of the actual antigen screening.
There's so many, sometimes it can seem like a Wild West out there with these different things, but Are there, you know, just also even in the stress that employees and employers have in figuring out what the best course is, are there good guidelines on these sort of things or best practices or places that are compiling this to help guide employees that the workers can reference, that the workplaces and offices can also find?
Yeah, you know, this time period right now reminds me of March, where in March it was a bit of a scramble and there was an overwhelming amount of information coming at people. It's hard to find the signal through the noise. And I think media organizations have done a really good job since that time of finding the right experts, elevating the right content. So I think that's gotten a lot better. What I see right now, why I think there's a parallel, is that right now everyone's thinking about, well, how can I figure out my return to office plan? And there are 101 different strategies out there. Every organization has an SOP, a standard operating procedures or protocols. And it's hard to know, well, which are the good ones? What should I use? So I would encourage you to add into your crisis management team someone with backgrounds in industrial hygiene, risk assessment, exposure science, public health, because this quickly gets into a conversation and a place where you're going to have to find, again, that signal through the noise, looking at what CDC is putting out, what WHO is putting out, what really good organizations. The American Industrial Hygiene Association is a great resource, has a back to work safely program. I'm a certified industrial hygienist, so I've vetted that. It looks pretty good to me. Again, the challenge here, though, is a lot of what people are putting out are these generalized strategies. And already in this conversation, we've gotten specific fast on childcare, daycare services, dental offices, and each building and environment are going to be really quite different. So the trick here is going to be able to take the generalized guidance and turn it into something specific and actionable for your organization. And that's not always so straightforward.
I'm just looking at a lot of the questions here because we are still getting quite a few and we have just a few minutes left, but people can still post. Here's a different one, but we've been talking about filtrations. It comes from Shirley. What type of air filtration systems do airplanes have? And when will it be safe to travel, really be safe to travel that way? And I would like to add on to that, the airports.
Yeah, so, you know, I direct the Healthy Buildings Program, but I don't think you knew this, Alana, but I've done work on airplanes for over 10 years, and I was the lead author on a National Academy's report on infectious disease mitigation in airports and on airplanes. So this is a topic I know well, and I've been thinking a lot about. And people are going to be really surprised to know that the air quality in the airplane is actually quite good. In fact, the levels and the targets they hit look a lot like what we hit or target in hospitals. So for example, I mentioned airborne infection isolation rooms in a hospital at 6 air changes per hour. In an airplane, you usually get 10 to 12 air changes per hour. The recirculated air in an airplane all runs through a HEPA filter. HEPA is 99.97% effective at capturing even the really small particles, including viral particles. So most of the air coming in from the airplane, 50% bled from the outside, it's called bleed air. It comes in, it's conditioned, it's delivered, and 50% is recirculated. Everything that gets recirculated goes through those HEPA filters. So while you're on the airplane, I think the air quality is actually quite good. It's a bit more nuanced to think about the whole travel experience, queuing a check-in, the security queues, getting your baggage, maybe a customs. Plus, when you travel, usually you don't sleep as well. You're taking public transportation. Maybe you're sleeping in a hotel. You're mixing with different people. So there's lots of other pressures on your immune system while you're traveling. So that's what makes this a really tricky environment. I do think there's a path forward. I kind of take that approach. I did forensic investigations of sick buildings for a long time. I haven't found a building or an environment we couldn't make safe. Even the worst performing places. So I'm optimistic that there is a path forward. We're just gonna have to manage it very carefully. As a resource, there is a report, if you're interested, that we wrote for the National Academies. It's ACRP report number 91, where you can look up infectious disease mitigation in airports and on airplanes, and I think you'll find it.
That's super helpful and interesting. I want to kind of now zoom out again. There's a question that's come in here about the hearing, the Senate hearing that's been happening today. And it's particularly about reopening, and Anthony Fauci testified amongst others. And so what we're seeing, this question is today in this hearing, is a focus on kind of the little picture and not the big picture. So the talk, like, for example, talking of how people are getting cavities that are going untreated because dentists are not taking patients. It doesn't seem like it's not a federal plan towards a structured reopening. Obviously, we have all these different now jurisdictions and businesses trying to figure things out. So does this speak to a unique challenge or reopening in the United States?
Yeah, I have to say, we've really, in my opinion, squandered our time since January in putting together a unified national plan to address this. We've seen other countries do it quite effectively in a shorter time frame, much shorter time frame. And we haven't got our act together, if you ask me. So we need a unified plan. It's been ad hoc. It's been state by state. That's problematic. This is not how a disease, this infectious disease doesn't respect borders, certainly not international borders or state borders. So we're already seeing some of these problems manifest. We bought ourselves an extra 2 months with these aggressive social distancing and lockdowns over the past 2 months. And still, we don't really have these systems in place. On Friday, I put out a new project with several colleagues in our Harvard Center for Communicable Disease Disease Dynamics. We call COVID Path Forward. You can find it at covidpathforward.com. And it's 13 priority areas that have to be enacted on with a full national mobilization to get control or to start to get control and bring this to a manageable position, including things like we've all heard at this point, wide-scale testing, contact tracing, self-quarantine, but also targeting high risk and vulnerable populations to provide precision support. It's gonna require a national healthcare mobilization, a scientific mobilization, which I think is actually underway, but also the private sector is gonna have to get involved, and every one of us are gonna have to do our part. So there's 13 priority areas. I hope you look at it and find it useful, and because for each one, we're updating it frequently where we see innovation happening in these priority areas as a way to track our progress towards a place where we can manage what we know will be a very difficult many months and years as we manage these expected multiple waves and recurrences in different regions at different times.
This question comes from Gerardo. It's, how can these measures be applied? Going back to the specific, that was a lot. So this is a poor transition, but also in looking, I don't even know that this is applied just to developing countries, but when you consider places that have so many informal businesses or low budgets, whether that's the US or elsewhere, like how are some of these measures that you're talking about even just now, but also when you think about the other aspects, how can that be applied, or what do you advise in those circumstances?
Yeah, it's challenging, right? A lot of organizations, people, even countries or regions can't do everything. And so I think what I like that first framework we opened with is it kind of gives you a sense of what you should aspire to and what you can do. There will be practical limitations for some places. They just simply won't be able to do it, either financially, the building won't be able to handle it, they won't be able to manage this. But if you start to throw in and get creative about the controls in these different buckets, you can get to a place where you minimize risk, right? You know, we said that there's no such thing as zero risk in anything, and certainly not during a pandemic. So we should be doing everything we can at each step to minimize that. And that's gonna look different for everybody based on their circumstances, the building, and factors that may be beyond their control. But it doesn't mean we should stop trying to target as many of these as we can to do our best to minimize risk as best as possible.
So unfortunately, this was a series of really great questions coming in, and thank you for your time, but we're about that point to wrap up. But before we do so, I just wanted to ask you, Joe, if you could give kind of some parting reflections on a piece of advice, let's say, for employees now who are transitioning to return to work.
Yeah, I know these are challenging times. It's probably most difficult, right, to make sense of the science, and the science seems to be changing sometimes. But if you pay attention to the experts, they're being pretty clear about what the science says in terms of disease dynamics and what you can and should do in terms of protecting your workers when the time is right as they come back to your offices and back to restarting the economy in a slow and steady way. I would say this is my parting hat. I'll put my professor hat on here. I like what our dean says. Dean Michelle Williams always says, whatever your skill, whatever your passion, there's a place for you in public health. This is public health's moment. We're all in public health right now. For many, it's maybe your first introduction to it. But this is really an all-in moment for society. And by that, I mean, look, scientists, I'm a scientist, I'll keep doing the science. We need media and the reporters to keep reporting out. But, you know, everyone has a role. If you're a comedian, make us laugh. If you're a teacher, teach. We need everyone to play their role here if we're going to get through this. It's going to take a lot of social trust. And I think we've shown in the past that our society and people can be quite resilient when we put our minds to it and we actually get this national mobilization going with everybody contributing full force.
Joining me was Joe Allen. He's an assistant professor of exposure assessment science, and he directs the Healthy Buildings Program at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages, at Forum HSPH, and at PRI The World. And you can see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Join us again on Friday, May 15th at noon Eastern, when we'll be putting your questions to Michael Minna about COVID-19 antibody testing. Thanks for listening.